Welcome to Science Center D. It's the first time I've been in Science Center D, I think, although it looks an awful lot like Science Centers A, B, and C. But welcome.
Much smaller,
I'm told. I haven't done a recount of the seats, but much smaller, I'm told. So welcome to Science Center D for a discussion of sorts about Napster, Harvard, copyright, and music. We have an amazing panel actually pulled together to discuss this, a wonderful sort of live case study of Harvard, in which I'd imagine at least many of us have some personal stake in the outcome of this ongoing digression. And what I'm hoping to do is sort of just have a conversation among the panelists for a bit, and then at some point kind of turn into a conversation among all of us as we first examine how things have unfolded so far with Napster, particularly as it relates to Harvard, and some of the decision-making that went into where things stand now, and get a handle on exactly where things stand now and why, and finally, where they're likely to go in the future, whether it's on Napster or on the siblings of Napster that have already sprung up to take its place. So that's what I'm hoping to do. I think we have to be done. What time do we have to be done? Any old time. I have to be somewhere at 5:30, so this certainly will not go any longer than 5:29 and 30 seconds. So with that, maybe we can introduce our panelists sort of one at a time. And I want to start with Dan Moriarty. Dan, you're the assistant provost of Harvard University. In that post, what do you do? What's a typical day for Dan Moriarty?
That's a good question. I largely work with colleagues across the university in managing information technology resources, people like Frank, senior.
Uh-huh. Okay, this is good. And Frank is the director of FAS Computer Services. Good. Welcome, Frank. Thank you for agreeing to be here. So, Dan, at some point, the president of the university got a letter from the lights are not working, you say, Scott? Oh, okay. I'll bellow louder in the meantime. Dan, at some point, you got a letter, or I'm sorry, President Rudenstine got a letter from, of all things, Metallica's lawyers. Metallica's lawyers sent Harvard a letter, sent President Rudenstine a letter. What did the letter say?
The letter, in essence, asked the university to ban access on the part of the Harvard community, in essence, the network that we run and manage, to the Napster site. The letter, I thought, was interesting in a couple of dimensions. The first was that the letter cited similar requests made to other universities who actually had been named in a lawsuit that the Metallica and Dr. Dre's attorneys had instigated against Napster. Well, basically, I believe it was Yale, USC, and the University of Illinois were named as co-defendants. In one of the prefacing comments kind of said to us, the threat of a lawsuit notwithstanding, here's why we think you should be morally or ethically interested in banning access to Napster. So, a couple of things about the letter that I think were pertinent. One is it had a clear, I thought, threat of an impending lawsuit to it. And so part of the question was, what might that path look like and what are the issues? But the most important dimension, I think, for us was, in fact, that when you look at this request, in fact, it was a request for the university, in essence, to take what I would call a presumptive action. This was a situation that was before the courts. It, in fact, had been appealed. In part, the way we interpreted this was that to comply with this request was, in essence, putting us in a position to act like a court, to make a judgment ourselves on the potential legality or not of this request. Obviously, another critical point for the university was the longstanding principle of maintaining open networks, of not monitoring or filtering traffic on the networks, and in essence supporting the spirit of broad inquiry and academic freedom that has already been expressed, I think, in our response to Napster.
So you get a letter from Metallica's lawyers that says, do the right thing, Harvard, and if you don't, who knows what could happen next, and you've got deep pockets, the endowment stands at $19 billion now? So what?
That's right.
And I guess Harvard, for many things, self-insures. My car was broken into in the Everett garage. I found out that Harvard self-insures, and so it was Harvard that told me they wouldn't give me any money, but I digress. So you get the letter that says, do the right thing. If you don't, who knows what might happen. And the right thing is stop people from accessing www.napster.com, or if they download the Napster client and use it to start grabbing music or sharing music, which is to say MP3 files, don't let that happen. Was it both or either?
It was really just getting access to the Napster site.
Just to the Napster site. So if you ban access to the Napster site, does that mean that if you have the Napster client, it won't work?
Because of the file sharing architecture of Napster, there obviously are existing files that would continue to be used by users of Napster. But in essence, what it would do would be to stop members of our community from having access to Napster and therefore the files that are indexed in Napster.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, Eva, you want to begin?
Supposedly, Napster has to connect to the Napster server in order to work. So I've heard at some schools, they will just have it route their DNS is configured such that if you try to go to Napster, it'll reroute to 127.0.0.1, which is like your own network, and obviously it won't run then.
So that would be one way of preventing students from getting to Napster. You send them back to themselves, and they already have the music that they have, so it's not a very productive music sharing community. So let me just digress for a moment and introduce Terry Fisher, professor of law at Harvard Law School. Terry, you study this stuff. Built in to do the right thing, can you help us understand from a legal standpoint, presuming, and I don't know if it's safe to presume this, but presume for just a minute that most of what happens on Napster is the swapping of MP3 files for which the copyright holders exist and are none too pleased about the swapping. Is Eva, should she do such a thing? Grab a song off a fellow Napster user site and then enjoy it to her heart's content, is she doing the wrong thing, legally speaking?
If she, an individual Napster user, copies a copyrighted song and then replays it multiple times for her enjoyment, yes, she's violating the copyright law. She's violating specifically Section 106 of the copyright law in the United States, which gives copyright owners the exclusive right to, among other things, reproduce the copyrighted material. And so she is reproducing the copyrighted material without permission. She's violating the copyright law. There are some complexities behind there. This is the copyright in the recording industry, recording company. Is it in the musician? Is it in the composer? We could go into those, but it's not necessary for these purposes. Things get more complicated, however, when you turn your attention from Eva to an organization that's contributing to or facilitating or encouraging her activities. So Harvard could, under these circumstances, were the suit that Dan described ever brought, invoke the same defenses that Napster has sought to invoke. They would be presented slightly differently, the facts would be slightly different, but it's the same legal categories that Harvard would invoke. And so specifically, there are three defenses Harvard could assert. One is it could try to fit into one of the so-called safe harbor provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which are designed to shield various types of service providers against liability when, to simplify it a bit, they're not actively involved in the activity of infringement. That's one possibility. Second possibility is there's a provision of a complicated and obscure statute known as the Audio Home Recording Act, which Harvard, on behalf of its students, could argue provides a safe harbor to the individual users, and so it, by contributing their activities, is not engaged in illegal behavior. Both of those arguments will probably lose in the Napster case and would probably lose if Harvard invoked them. The third of the arguments is the most complicated and interesting. The third of the arguments is that the Napster has asserted, and Harvard could assert, the benefit of the so-called Sony defense, which grows out of the Sony case, the Betamax case, decided in 1984 by the United States Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court held, by a bare margin, 5-4 vote, that two things. First, time shifting a copyrighted television program or movie, meaning recording it on your VCR, not unlike EVA for multiple play, but for playback once and only once at a later time, is a fair use. Even though it's a violation of the copyright law, it's a reproduction without permission, it's nevertheless privileged as a fair use of that copyrighted material for a complicated set of reasons, but one of them is most important. The most important reason is that it doesn't injure, doesn't result in any significant economic harm to the copyright owner. All right, that's the first of the two Sony holdings. And the second holding is that if a piece of technology, there was a VCR, is capable of a substantial non-infringing use, then to operate, to sell or operate that piece of technology is does not constitute contributory copyright infringement. So Napster has argued, and Harvard in a similar position could argue, that it's providing a technology, in Harvard's case, it's its system of connections to the internet, that is susceptible of significant non-infringing uses. So it shouldn't be liable for contributory copyright infringement. Now that's the argument that has gotten most attention, and deservedly so. It's the strongest of the arguments. In my view, in Napster's case, it should prevail. Whether it will or not is not clear, but it should prevail. And Harvard has an even stronger case. Well, why should it prevail? The reason it should prevail, in my view, to go to the heart of the matter here, is that EVA may not be, as you characterized her position, representative. That there is a significant, is conceivably even a majority, but it's not necessarily the big majority, percentage of users of Napster who employ it for so-called sampling purposes. When they use Napster, they don't intend actually to build permanent libraries of MP3 files. Why? Well, because the speakers on their computers are not great, and because MP3 files are less good than the files, the uncompressed digital files contained on CDs. So what they do is they download MP3 files, and they listen to them. And if they like them, they go out and they buy the CDs that from which the MP3 files were derived. And if they don't like them, they don't. So Napster is a way to sample music and decide whether you like it or not. That, in my view, should be privileged as a fair use for much the same reasons that time-shifting a copyrighted movie or television show was privileged in the Sony case.
So are you saying that the mere act of grabbing a Metallica song through Napster from someone else and putting it onto your hard drive, you can't yet say whether that is an infringement of copyright? You first have to peel back the scalp of the person who did it and decide whether they're intending to add it to a permanent record collection, or whether they actually do listen to it repeatedly and come to love it, or whether they merely sample it and then throw it away.
Yes, with the exception that you don't actually have to peel back their scalp, you just...
I'm relieved you're that, actually.
You just observe what they do with it. And if they listen to it a few times and then purchase or don't purchase the CD, depending on whether they care about it, and delete the file, that's sampling.
And would the symmetry hold for somebody sharing music over Napster to someone else? Eva makes her collection available, and sure enough, somebody comes in on her Napster port, takes that Metallica song, and whether or not Eva has engaged in copyright infringement hinges on what the person who grabbed it later does with it?
Yes.
Interesting. So we could gather some empirical data here, I suppose, a self-selected group of people who show up to wonder about the future of Napster at Harvard. How many of you actually have used Napster? I'm shocked. How many of you have used Napster to add to your quasi-permanent collections and grab some favorites? And how many of you are merely sampling when you take the stuff, and there's one guy, and have you actually been known to buy the CD later after you sample?
Actually, I have a purchase list in my pocket.
It's like a list of communists or something. 52 CDs. So, okay, would it matter, that empirical test? Suppose we brought in the statisticians, and Metallica sends a follow-up letter to President Rubenstein, it gets routed to Dan, and the letter says, we've done some surveys, and in fact, we have found that most people use it to add to their personal collections and aren't using it just to sample and then buy later.
Well, strictly speaking, if you apply verbatim to the Supreme Court's ruling in the Sony case, no, it doesn't matter. The reason it doesn't matter is that the standard articulated in the case was, is the technology susceptible or capable of a significant non-infringing use? And so if it's capable of serving as a vehicle for sampling, that's enough to shield Napster and Harvard in an analogous position from liability for contributory copyright infringement. Now, having said that, I should go on to say that courts that have applied the Sony decision since Sony don't always do so by applying its criteria verbatim. They are, as you might expect, sensitive to empirical evidence about how frequently the technology is used for illicit purposes or not. And so whether the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit will find in favor of Napster on this basis is hard to predict.
Gotcha.
If I had to bet at this point, my guess would be the Ninth Circuit would be likely to affirm the lower court's ruling and find against Napster.
Gotcha.
But for the reasons I suggested, there's a very strong argument why they should not. So returning briefly to the position of Harvard, I think Dan is exactly right in observing that what Metallica was trying to induce Harvard to do was anticipate a highly unpredictable court ruling to move in a preemptive fashion to immunize itself from liability in advance of the court's ruling from the standpoint of what would be best from the in terms of public evaluation and usage of this technology. It seems to me clear Harvard did the right thing, leaving for judicial determination this issue, after which they can make judgments about whether they should block usage or not.
So let's make sure we understand exactly what Harvard did in response to the letter. You gave somewhat a response as you were describing your reaction to this letter. Harvard actually sent a letter back to Metallica's lawyers, dear Metallica's lawyers, thanks so much for your recent letter to President Rudenstine, and what did you say? You said?
We, in essence, respectively declined to comply and also invited them to follow the provisions of DMCA, which calls for incidences of claimed copyright violation to be identified, for us to be notified, and that we would take appropriate action. In fact, the Harvard homepage has a button on it that says report copyright violations here. And so this is not something...
This is not a confessional. This is for other people to report it.
This is anticipated. I just wanted to comment on one thing.
Yeah.
This case, this situation is obviously important and interesting. The precedent that a university, including Harvard, might set by assuming responsibility to preemptively make judgments of this type is a much broader issue and one that frankly worried us more than this case, i.e., where are you in 5 years if you set a precedent that potentially illegal, not proven illegal sites are within your responsibility to identify and block?
Right.
And if you start down that path, when does possibly illegal become possibly immoral and possibly offensive and possibly politically incorrect, and where you end up? And that really looked like a completely untenable scenario for us to set a precedent. So.
Well, I want to end up pursuing that little button you click to report copyright infringement and see how that would play out. But before we do, I want to come to a better understanding of if there was any other action Harvard took vis-a-vis Napster in this time period. We saw at least one slide go by reporting from the Harvard Crimson having to do with the behavior of Napster outgoing packets. Frank, are you in the best position to explain that?
Yeah, probably. When after the university sent this note, we had a very busy weekend. It was the weekend before the Napster decision was supposed to be heard, and it turned out that the press reported a 22% increase in network traffic on that weekend every
day. People were getting their looks in before it got shut
right,
down.
Right, plus the law school had a forum which discussed it as well and which used our network here, which caused a lot of heavy network traffic.
Always blame the law school.
Yeah, well, it was only the Berkman Center.
Right.
But in any case, we've always reserved the right to protect our network users from activities that make it impossible to maintain the academic mission. And so We found that weekend that the outgoing Napster traffic was up to 14 megabit, which is our entire network feed last year. I mean, this year we've got more.
How much more do we have this year?
We're at 135 now, but we were at 45. Yeah, we were at 45 before. We
have a real thick pipe.
We have a very thick pipe. Not only that, our dormitories, every student connection is a switch 10 megabit connection, so it's every desktop has a very fast connection.
But faculty are getting left behind.
No, faculty will have also fine connections as we move through the upgrades, and some have been done already.
Yeah.
But in any case, so we became targets for people outside to look for fast downloads of music. The inbound traffic was only 4 megabit, and outbound was 14. So we put a bandwidth limitation on Napster packets that reduced it to half a megabit. I don't know how the quotes with the numbers came up there. Well, we had a Crimson article, which we don't know how many songs there were.
Right.
Yeah.
So I reduced it to half a megabit. You're saying this was totally coincidental to the Metallica request.
I think it was related to the increase in Napster traffic, which was related to the potential closing down of Napster, which has not been decided yet.
And now that the Berkman Center conference is over and people have gotten used to Napster being back again, can the boom be raised?
No, we haven't raised it yet, and I don't believe we've received any complaints from students here about it. It hasn't. I mean, the question is, you know,
is there a button you can click to complain about?
No, because the complaint issue is: are you complaining that nobody can reach your machine to cause traffic on our network and slow down your machine to get music on it that you have? That would be the complaint. In other words, you're so generous with the music that you want to slow down both your network connection and all your work so that you can give your music away on Napster. And very often people have used Napster, they don't know that people go to your machine and move the music. So I think there's a good reason we haven't received complaints. And I think also it did greatly speed up the network. I mean, that weekend we did get complaints about the slowdowns on the network. We got lots of complaints.
And this is the post-OC3 network or the pre-OC3 network?
It was a post-OC3 network, but it still there's a lot of traffic.
So what happens now is you've managed to make it so that if somebody's using Napster and the request comes in by someone outside to grab a file, you'll try to ship the file through, but there's an overall cap, and everything has to go slowly enough so that cap is not exceeded.
It goes slowly. It just slows it down. So what you used to get instantly almost takes minutes now. So.
And if someone were to complain about this,
it would be outside the university. They would send us a letter saying, I tried to download music on one of your university computers and I couldn't. So
I was trying to watch a webcam on your daughter.
Yeah, right. But it was specifically Napster packets that we
So you've been shaking your head. What are you shaking your head about?
Well, it's not just affecting outside users, because some friends of mine and I have noticed that when you try to connect to the network, unless you set the number of files you're sharing equal to zero, then you can't get on the network. I waited a full minute yesterday to get on the network before I turned off file sharing, and then I could hop on instantly.
That's a minute that you'll never have back.
No.
So, all right, there's some technical bugs with it, but are you prepared to complain, presuming you iron out the bugs and people learn to set their files to zero, that kind of thing? Are you prepared to invoke your right to shove data at an incredible rate, so much so that Frank says it's going to slow down the network for everybody else, out to the outside world?
No.
You're not prepared to do that. And thus has there then been no particular uproar against this clamp on outgoing Napster?
No, I will say this in comment to this, it's very hard to restrict those packets as such, and that's one of the reasons why we were reluctant to do it at all. So it can affect other things, but it's particularly Napster. So I'm not surprised there's no uproar. I mean, the fact is that the network is there for student use and faculty use and staff use for academic purposes. It's hard for people to complain that they couldn't have entertainment on it because we were trying to protect academic use.
Well, it does seem like a kind of wonderful Kantian imperative, where if every university and network service provider did what you did, NAFTA would die because there'd be nobody to pull the stuff down from, so long as everybody restricted the outcome.
I think if you ask the general public, you'll find there's a lot more Napster use than just the universities. I think it's a mistake to say that it's universities that are at fault and that the music companies push,
right,
you know, lawsuits to universities is a show kind of thing. But it's surprising when you ask a general audience how many people use Napster. It's not the percentage that's here, but it's a surprisingly large number. And gray-haired people like me also use it, and it's also in fair numbers.
Only for evaluative purposes, of course.
It may not be for the same music.
Yeah. We've got the Chopin's lawyer is something exactly. All right, fascinating. Now, if Napster traffic downloads onto campus should one day hit that 15 megabit level, you're suggesting that you might at least be empowered. You'd have the technical expertise to put a similar clamp on Napster downloads, but no others. Is that right?
Yeah. It's not 100% selective, but yes.
So, Dan, if we know that most of the Napster use, in fact, it is quite possible that every single bit of the Napster use is not for academic and research purposes, it's for entertainment, why should Harvard be getting any bandwidth to it?
Well, if you look at what some other colleges have done, it's really, I think, a completely different set of issues. It has nothing to do with intellectual policy or network management. It's simply economics. If you're Colby University and you're spending $1 million a year on your networking infrastructure and a third of that is going to MP3 traffic, you're spending a lot of money.
I guess the student activities fee would have to be augmented with the lawyer's fee and then with the student network fund fee.
And I think you've seen some colleges and universities legitimately clamp down. It's just a value judgment about can we afford to allow this traffic to grow in a way that's not meeting our academic priorities.
How much does our OC3 cost per year, roughly?
It's about that amount. It's about $1 million.
About $1 million a year to wire the entire campus with a fast.
Just our commercial internet connection. It's the entire Harvard campus and, in fact, all the affiliated hospitals come together and go to the internet together. Our pipe is so big that the percentage of MP3 traffic is relatively small. It's about 5% when we last looked at it. It's 5% of a lot of traffic, so it's not an insignificant amount of net traffic. It's probably more than a Colby or a Bates is showing in traffic. So it's a little misleading.
Gotcha. So let's turn for a moment to the question of this copyright infringers report. If you're working for Metallica and you're looking to do a couple showboat, high-profile suits against those grabbing music, how, if you know that somewhere on the Harvard campus there's an undergrad listening to Metallica tunes repeatedly as part of a permanent library, how would you be in a position to find out who that person is? Frank, are you the right person to answer this? Pretend you were hired special consultant from Metallica.
Well, I think the issue that keeps coming up is people who distribute this music willfully, rather than people who are listening to it. And these are where the actual complaints have come. And this is where, when a complaint comes, that we have to act to stop this illegal distribution. So, and there, we actually get information from the resources outside the, what is it, RIAA.
The Recording Industry Association?
Right, as to who it is, or to what, at least what computer it is. And then we have to act to have that.
So how often does this happen?
What do we say, 5 times it's happened? Something like that.
So 5 Harvard community members have found themselves, the long arm of the law has come to their dorm room or something and said, the RIAA has said that your computer is responsible for a lot of master file sharing, and now what?
Well, it's the student administrative system. It's not a long arm of the law from the outside. And as far as I know, they've all complied. They didn't, from what I could tell, they didn't understand that they were violating the law and they were doing.
They had no idea. So you want to work the RIA and say, thank you so much for identifying the student that was shipping off.
I don't think we've gone that far, but we have to comply. I mean, it's our responsibility when a complaint comes to investigate and to deal with it in a way that complies with the law.
So, Terry, maybe you can explain, just under these notice and takedown provisions, these other pieces of the DMCA, what could Metallica or the RIAA rightfully demand of Harvard as far as finding out who is violating copyright for their stuff, and what could they demand be done about it?
Well, the short answer is not clear at this point.
The short answer is it's not clear under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act exactly what the recording industry could demand of Harvard. The relevant safe harbor provision of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was actually designed with a somewhat different problem in mind. The problem that the drafters of this rather poorly drafted statute had principally in view was a traditional internet service provider, AOL or CompuServe, something, allowing its subscribers to post material on their own homepages. Some of that material turning out to be infringing, and then the ISP, a traditional ISP, as I say, AOL or CompuServe, facing the danger of contributory or direct copyright infringement liability because of their participation in the illegal activity. The traditional ISPs quite plausibly argued that under these circumstances it would be very bad social policy to hold them liable. Why would it be very bad social policy? Well, they'd have to do one of two things. They would either have to engage in crude surveillance of their own members. You can't examine in detail the activities of each of the millions of subscribers, so they'd have to have very crude surveillance systems. For example, anything that looked like a musical file, they'd remove automatically, or anything that looked like a graphic file that had elements suggestive of pornography would be removed, which would involve quite a bit of censorship. That'd be one unfortunate outcome. And the other unfortunate alternative outcome would be that the ISPs would pay a lot of money in damages and would just take it out of the hides of their subscribers by raising the subscription fees, which would result in a lot of unfortunate cross-subsidies that the 99% of the non-infringing subscribers would be subsidizing a few bad apples. So against that backdrop, the ISPs argued plausibly that they should be immunized against liability if more or less they were innocent. And so the relevant safe harbor provision provides that if they don't have direct knowledge or good reason to suspect that a particular file is infringing, and if they stand ready to remove a file upon being notified that it is infringing, they're home free.
And the act of removing a file when the file is on a student's hard drive open to master sharing is the act of calling up the student and saying, say, why don't you turn that off?
Well, again, the DMCA doesn't specify, but that would seem to be a natural application of the provision, yes, to Harvard's situation. But as I say, adapting the DMCA to the position of Harvard involves a lot of tweaking, because Harvard is not what the drafters of the DMCA had in mind when they constructed this provision. What they had in mind was somebody like AOL or CompuServe, and Harvard is in a somewhat different position to its subscribers. Often will have better information about its subscribers than CompuServe or AOL will, and also has arguably, and this is Dan's territory, a somewhat more parens patriae relationship to its subscribers. The relationship between CompuServe and its customers is arm's length commercial. The relationship between Harvard and its students is not so obviously arm's length and commercial. So that's all to suggest that the scheme sketched in the DMCA doesn't translate very cleanly to the context of Harvard.
So, Eva, you're clearly technically inclined. You sort of know your stuff. When Frank arranges the network so that you can't share stuff through Napster anymore going out. Can you get around it?
Yeah. First of all, a lot of things have cropped up. There's Navigator, which is essentially the
Navigator?
Yeah. Which is not affiliated in any way with Napster. But it's made by somebody else, and it uses the same protocols and the same client. It just uses individual servers. And so instead of having centralized servers belonging to Napster.com, they belong to various people who put them up. It's also...
So you can start sharing stuff at the old rate, the OC3 rate, or the switch 10 megabit rate as soon as you go to Navigator.
Well, I think, Frank, are you, it depends. At some schools, they have it such that big traffic, like MP3s, just gets put on the bottom of the list, and that is only allowed to go slowly. But I think here we just close up the port.
Yeah, we just close up the port that goes to Napster, not MP3s in general.
So if you just pick a new port, then you can just spew out MP3s.
So
but
how do
you go to the server? These are point-to-point. This Navigator and Nutella are things that go point to point and don't have to go to the server, so that's another
right. Difficult
one to control.
So how many people here have heard of Navigator? And for those who haven't, how many of you are planning to learn more about Navigator? All right, so we have there's a hole in the dam that's been plugged for a little bit, but there's people chiseling away from the other side. And it's true, we've got another generation of this stuff, whether it's Navigator or Nutella or FreeNet. We go to this peer-to-peer thing. Frank, are you prepared, should it be deemed either for we want to do the right thing, even in light of academic freedom concerns, or we're worried about bandwidth, for whatever reason, are you in a technical position to start plugging the holes as fast as Eva can chisel them?
I don't know if we can do it as fast as others can chisel them, but we can try and I mean, again, it's our responsibility to keep the network going, so we take that seriously, and we try to do what we can. There are a number of technical things that we could do. We don't like to do them because they are not, for the most part, so selective. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what you do, so that means other things get trapped in it, and that causes a problem.
Now, I guess there are two ways you could try to, if you're trying to constrain people's behavior, which in some sense you are, you want them to use the network one way and not another. One way to do it is just try to make the network so it can't be used the way you don't want it to be used, and then people chisel around and try to just figure out a way around it and then you plug it. I suppose the other way is just to take really good notes of how people are using it, and in the event that they use it in a way they're not supposed to use it, you know where they live. You can come find them and just get them in trouble, right? I mean, who wants to be expelled over something like this?
That's never been something that we do, and we don't monitor what people are doing. We have tried to deal with in a general way to what's going on in the network. That's why Napster was good to control or easy to control because it always went to the same port.
Right.
And that way it didn't matter what a particular individual was doing, we could control the Napster traffic.
Right.
But we can do various other kinds of bandwidth limitations. Various universities are doing that in order to protect the traffic on the network in general. I saw an article in the Stanford Daily newspaper about limitations that they've taken and students complaining about how slow the network had become. So there are many other universities doing such general kinds of limitations, largely for the same reasons that Dan mentions. The issue is just how much of university resources should go toward unlimited use of one particular activity, and it's a general question. It's not an IT or technical question at all. It's a resource limitation question. It's a policy question, and so on.
Gotcha. I hear you definitely trying to narrow this small tweak to the network to as much of a pinpoint as possible. Terry, maybe you can tell us quickly where you think the next steps are going to be. What are the next shoes that are going to fall? What's going to be the discussion next year this time? And then maybe we can open it up to general discussion and questions from the crowd.
Well, I think the discussion has already brought out most of the themes. With one exception.
Oh, I'm closer to the mic again, sorry.
The one exception is that in the past few weeks, principal developers of innovative technology in this area have been caving in. So Napster itself, I think 2 weeks ago, cut a deal with the parent company of one of the big five recording companies. It took a big step in the direction of converting its current system into a subscription-based system. MP3.com just yesterday cut a deal with the last of the five recording companies and settled its that lawsuit, agreeing to pay somewhere near $170 million total to the recording industries, and then to pay them fees in the future for usage of their system. It's not Napster, but it's a loosely analogous regime. Scour.com has gone bankrupt now. Scour is an even more comprehensive and effective file sharing system than Napster was. So the recording industry is on a roll. They're on a roll not only in winning lawsuits or winning early stages of lawsuits, but even more seriously, they are inducing the main players in this field to kneel down. So what's going to happen from here? Well, one trajectory is encouraged. The recording industry will go ever deeper into the set of participants in this new technology. Having successfully knocked over the most visible players, they'll go after less and less obvious intermediaries, including the universities, for example. And if the courts continue to be enthusiastic, they'll continue to prevail. And as the stream of victories adds up, fewer and fewer people will be willing to take the risks that Harvard has actually taken in this instance. All right, that's one grim scenario. The other scenario is the one that Eva sketches, is on the contrary, the victories of the recording industry will prove illusory because the centralized and relatively corporate intermediaries, MP3.com and Napster.com, will be replaced by decentralized, headless systems, which can't be stopped. Specifically, the Napster deal will collapse because nobody will subscribe. The 25 million subscribers of Napster will flee to free systems elsewhere. So these are two radically different scenarios as to what's likely to happen in the near future. In the background, so contribute 30 seconds my own sense of this. Why do I describe the first of the scenarios as grim? It's grim because there are extraordinary economic and social benefits to internet distribution of unsecured musical files. Huge cost savings, great social and cultural advantages. And if the result of the legal campaign and the retreat of the first line of intermediaries is to shut down this mode of distribution, we will have lost a great deal economically, socially, and culturally.
So there's a microphone, I guess, there, to which I encourage you to go if you want to say something, especially because I think it's being recorded. So I encourage you somebody from the general counsel's office is either fleeing or coming out for a comment.
I'm actually taking off my mask. My name is Alan Ryan. My claim to fame is that if you press that button on the Harvard homepage that says report copyright infringements here, my name I'm the one that gets copyright complaints that other people file on Harvard's homepage. And as a matter of fact, this morning I came in, I checked my email, and lo and behold, there was a complaint from the RIAA that said, we've located a person at Harvard, imagine that, who has a lot of MP3 files on the site and is allowing other people to copy them. And they gave an IP address, and I sent the IP address off to Frank. I said, Frank, do we know who lives here? And he sent me back a name and the house where this student lives. And I sent the whole thing off to the senior tutor of the house, and I said, look, would you please sit down with the student and explain that, A, this is copyright infringement, but B, and more to the point, it would be an excellent idea for this student to disassemble this site and get out of the crosshairs of the RIAA, because if he doesn't, he or she is subject to being terminated from the Harvard network, and we would not like to do that.
Is the RIAA crosshairs better targeted now? Did you tell the RIAA who the student was?
No. Well, so far we haven't told the RIAA. This has happened half a dozen times before, and I don't like to tell the RIAA who the student is. We just say, look, the IP site that you...
We've given a talking to this student.
That's right. It's not a problem anymore. It's gone. Thank you very much. See you later. And so far that's worked. One of the things that leads me into really the main thing that I just wanted to say to add to the very enlightening discussion here this afternoon. We have taken some steps to get the word out to students, I mean to all users of the Harvard Network, but I think particularly students. The fact that Harvard decided not to turn off access to NAFSTER should not be mistaken as either saying we don't think this is a problem, we don't think it's illegal, or we'll go to bat for you. None of those three things are true.
Even though you don't think it's illegal, we'll go to bat for them.
We can't. What we have done is to say, look, Harvard is not going to put itself in the position of saying to students, here's what you can read, here's what you can look at, here's what you can listen, here's what you can download. That is a decision that every student makes on their own, and then they're responsible for what they do. We thought it might be easy to read our decision as saying to students, hey, look, we'll protect you as long as you're on the Harvard network. We're not going to turn off access to NAFSTER, so you're okay. In fact, there is a provision in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that says that Metallica, to take the example, does not have to crank up a full-fledged federal case copyright infringement lawsuit. All they have to do is come to the network owner, to Harvard, and say IP address 1 through 100 is a repeat infringer of our copyrights, and we request that A, you give us their names through the subpoena process, and two, that you terminate their access to the Harvard network. The DMCA has only been around for 2 years. This, as far as we know, has not happened anywhere yet. It hasn't happened at Harvard at any rate. And I'm not sure what it leads to. We don't want to turn off anybody's network access. Obviously, it's a huge problem for students not to have network access. So we're not eager to do that at all. But the law is the law. Does it mean if someone comes and says, for example, this IP address is a repeat infringer, does Harvard, then are we able to go and say, hey, geez, disassembled your site, or you're subject to being terminated from the network? In other words, do they get a second chance? Or does Metallica say, no, repeat infringer. Here is the dates of all the time. You've got to terminate them from the network now. No further chances. I don't know what the law requires there. So my point is simply that we need users of the network to be aware. If you're going to go to NAFSTER, you're on your own. There's nothing that we can do to stand between you and Metallica if and when they come. Now, maybe they'll never come. Maybe it'll never be a problem. Maybe this whole thing will go away. I mean, I think in the long run, this is clearly a transitional stage. I think in the end, there's going to have to be some agreement, as now there may be, between Bertelsmann and NAFSTER that says, look, let's do this together and people will pay for it. But until that day comes, the point just has to be made that users of NAFSTER are proceeding at their own risk.
And you do have the data in hand that should you be hit with a subpoena and choose to comply with it, you could pretty much identify...
Well, sure.
Users
sure. I mean, the key is the IP address. NAFSTER can tell what IP addresses concern them. We know, obviously, as to any IP address, where that is at Harvard. Congress, when it enacted the DMCA, said if Metallica comes to Harvard with a subpoena, just like any other subpoena, we've got to comply with it if it's served lawfully. So that's the key there, that we, under power of legal process, may have to give up these names to Metallica if it comes to that.
Gotcha. discussion here?
Yeah, the thing I'm curious about is, I'm not sure exactly how the RIAA determines that someone at a particular IP address is infringing. My understanding of it is I think they're monitoring network traffic, so they know that many requests or packets have come through this. It's very difficult to tell, for instance, if you have a Metallica song, Enter Sandman. You don't know whether that's something that came off a CD, which is technically a copyright violation, or a live recording. I mean, everything is pretty much, or it might not even be a Metallica song at all. A lot of it is dependent on the file name. So it seems
a little unclear. You might not even know even if it did come from the CD, whether it's infringement, because maybe the person was just trying before they buy.
Right. Or a lot of network traffic might be going, you know, if a student on campus, for instance, had a lot of independent music that was being sent out. I'm curious as to whether there's almost a presumption of guilt when the RIAA sends someone's IP address and then it generates this whole thing to, you know, send something to talk to the student. What would happen if the student were to claim, well, this really isn't infringing use at all? Are we simply taking the recording industry's word on that?
Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
No, we're not taking the recording industry's word for it. As a matter of fact, tell you just a quick story. About a year ago, or 2 years ago now, we got a complaint from Apple saying that a particular student was using what was then a new Apple video campaign and had taken away the actual words of the 60-second TV spot and had replaced them with rude and obscene words on his site.
This is for an academic project?
This is just for fun. And I looked at the site, and it was pretty funny.
Legal judgment.
It was my considered legal judgment that it was actually pretty funny. And so I went back to Apple, and I said, sorry, this is parody. This is okay. This is fair use. This is not a copyright infringement. And they wrote back and said, well, you may be right, thank you, and that was the end of it. So the answer is no, we don't take anybody's word. And if, just to use this case this morning, if the student who was named said, wait a minute, this is a big mistake, this is not my machine, or you know, I mean, sure, obviously we'll listen to that. But the point is that if these are, if this is commercially recorded music that doesn't fit into any of these oddball things like parody, then it is a copyright infringement. And really, our advice to the student at that point is don't be nuts. Take it down. Get out of the way.
Gotcha. Scott Radner, one of the architects of the Internet.
Marty. Couple of technical points. Question was asked, how do they find out? Well, actually, the way Metallica's lawyers found out about Metallica stuff at Napster is they connect to Napster, and they just go down and scan for Metallica song names. And they find out where they're being offered from, and they just list them. They listed 300 and some 1,000 of them back to Napster at one point. So it's actually quite easy to find out who is offering songs. So
well, it'll pretty much be as easy, whether it's Napster or Navigator or Nutella or Freenet?
No. No. Well, yes and no, in the sense that it's easier to find the list because there is one list with Napster. The other is a distributed list. And it's dynamic based on what machines are connected at that instance. So it's a little harder to do. But basically, you wind up with a list of people who are saying they have these songs. Now, maybe they're lying. Maybe it's fraud. But, you know, it's cheap fraud if it's fraud, because they're not charging anything for it. So that's relatively easy. I just wanted to nip on something else that just you may have misspoke something in one of your questions. Harvard doesn't provide Napster with a set of IP addresses. Or Napster doesn't come and say, this set of people are doing something. It comes in with specific individual IP addresses.
And Harvard has to decide whether or not to correlate those with a name.
The text that Alan referred to about sending out a notice to get people aware of what's going on here is a specific piece of text that's been worked out. It's still in process a little bit. You may have seen it around in some of the libraries are starting to post it. And it basically says that people need to be aware that there are copyright laws and that you need to adhere to them, just like you do with copying books in a copy center. And that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act does have the provision of removing somebody from the network. Now, just a second.
Yeah.
One thing that's not clear is what network that is. It says you have to remove them from the network. That could be Harvard's network. It could be Harvard's Harvard could claim that means that the student couldn't get to the internet. That would be less of a penalty. But in either case, it's not been adjudicated, as Alan mentioned, so we don't know what the courts will say that it means.
I see. You mean you could eventually cut somebody off from the internet but leave them on the intranet that is .harvard.edu or something?
One might, Harvard might take that tact.
But the wordsmithing here is at least as much for the edification of students saying, oh yeah, I should obey copyright law, as it is for later legal processes that may...
The later legal processes were kept in mind. But yes, it is not just students. I want to be very clear about this, that it's not just students. It is any user of the Harvard network is subject to these provisions. And the provisions are not Harvard's provisions. They're copyright provisions. The copyright provisions do have a fair use exception, but that fair use exception is purposely vague in the law so that it can track technology changes, among other things. But it's not something where you can look at something and say, this is an exception. You have to make the assumption it's probably not.
Gotcha. Yeah.
My question is primarily for Professor Fisher, but I'd welcome everyone else to respond. With increasing technology, my understanding is that people will increasingly be able to download not only MP3 music files, but also MP4 video files to the point where they could download full movies onto their computers. How do you think this will affect the sort of legal... What are the legal ramifications, or I guess the differences between that and MP3 files? Certainly the argument about sampling would seem a lot less valid because people don't generally sample movies. They watch them and either enjoy them or don't enjoy them, and that's that. So what do you think the difference would be between this?
Well, it's already happening. Actually, much of the traffic on scour.com was in video files. You're entirely right that... it's less likely that the participants in an analogous trafficking in video files could plausibly assert a fair use defense based on sampling because, just as you point out, the usage of video files tends to be quite different from the usage of musical files, tends to be one shot rather than repetitive. So with that exception, they are structurally identical, the two fields, video and music enjoy the same degree of copyright protection. Actually, that's not quite true, but the respects in which they're different aren't relevant here. So almost identical issues will arise if there is a successor to scour.com, or more plausibly, if there is a video analog to Nutella or Freenet. It'll be the same questions that will come up soon.
Charlie Nesson.
I actually have two questions that are both extensions of this idea that perhaps the industry will win its current battles and keep going. The first involves Harvard. Let's suppose, and perhaps this is best addressed to Alan Ryan, let's suppose that Metallica comes after Harvard as hard as it can. The question is, would Harvard be in a better position if we acted proactively right now to define our policy in a way that defines what we take to mean repeat infringer and what we take to mean appropriate response and what we take to mean network? That is, state our policy so that we have up front something that we're following and that we are then in a position to defend if and when Metallica comes after us.
That's
a good idea, but I'm not. I don't think it's Metallica that we really have to worry about in that situation. It is the court, because if Metallica comes and says, "Look, here are the repeat infringers, cut them off from the network," we at that point we say, "No, we'll cut them off from the internet, but we'll leave them on the intranet." Or no, they're entitled to a fair warning before they're truly ripped. All of those arguments are made to the court, and it may be that having a policy in place beforehand might marginally impress a judge. But I think in the end, it's probably not going to carry the day one way or the other. But that is a good idea.
I can't tell people how much they can get away with, because I can't even say you can get away with one.
I mean, two might make you a repeat infringer. You could download two songs from Napster and be a repeat infringer if you want to take a really draconian view of it. I mean, it's just such a clean slate. There have been no cases on this at all, so we've got no real sense of how courts are going to go on.
Okay, go with number two?
Go for number two.
Number two. Supposing that the Napster case loses, so that in some sense Napster is declared to be illegal, it would seem to follow that Nutella and Navigator and Freenet then would fall into the same pattern. At that point, what does the university do with respect to traffic that goes on with these other forms of software? That is, I guess, mostly to you, Frank, to both Frank and Dan, would there be, first of all, an impetus to prevent that kind of traffic, Nutella traffic, on the university network from a legal point of view? And would it be possible to do it in an effective way from a technical point of view?
My first reaction, Charlie, is if you draw an analogy, let's imagine there's a bar downtown where it's alleged one can buy cocaine. The analogy here is we would be asked to prevent students from driving downtown. And so the first thing I would say is shut the bar. Don't ask us to shut down Sturro Drive so students can't get there.
Guns don't kill people, bullets kill people.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I think the first reaction to this kind of question is the appropriate remedy is if a court decides that a site is offending, that they should go after the site, not the intermediary. I guess that's my initial reaction. The second reaction is, you know, when asked to do something by a court, obviously we consider it, but I think the notion, again, of taking presumptive or preemptive action to block traffic gets us into that network management policy dilemma that I think we have to avoid. So I think our reaction would be not unlike the DMCA compliance reaction, which is when approached with a request by a court to take an action, we consider it. But in absence of that, I would hope we continue to run open networks.
At the risk of, Frank, did you want to speak to that?
I think that, again, I always point out that we're IT people and the policies go on through the Harvard policy boards, deans, and so on. So it's a little hard to say what they would say, but if technically we knew a lot about Napster and we've been playing with filters for it for some time, also we've been trying to monitor the traffic for some time.
Statistically speaking,
I mean we would see, if we would do things like try to filter Napster for a short period of time and see if network traffic changed, and it didn't. These were things that we were trying to see if Napster was significant. And for a long time, it was.
Everybody was the guinea pig there.
It was the issue there was measurement. I don't know if anybody suffered from it. I don't know if anybody noticed it. But in fact.
What's that?
Yeah. Well, this is the kind of thing you have to do if you manage a network. You have to see if there is something that goes on. But in any case, the Nutella thing. I think there are ways of blocking the packets, but it becomes somewhat more intrusive, and that's really the issue as to whether that would be something we would want to do or not.
Like if he was already grinning, thinking about how.
Yeah. Scott's an expert on this. Maybe would add a little bit to it.
It takes about 15 minutes of programming to make it so you can't block it.
So
use agile ports, change the packet types, and you don't have anything to hang a hook on.
Are people writing
this down? It's well known, so that's not a big deal.
Yeah, not Napster, but Nutella.
Nutella and Freenet and all of these, they can be port agile, which means they're not going to a particular port.
Right.
They're just going to something at a random.
Right. The question is if you can analyze the packets themselves.
And it's very hard to. It's actually very easy to masquerade them by putting a bit of random numbers at the beginning, for example. It's pretty hard
it's
to
like
keep up with these.
CNN.com and in fact you're downloading after.
Or, well, probably not CNN, but, Jonathan NN or something, but somebody.
But yes, it's actually pretty hard to keep up with the kind of dynamic nature of the internet. The whole point of the internet is that people at the edges can innovate. The people, they don't have to have permission from the people in the middle, and that's what got us.
There's a cycle. I mean, the intrusion cycles are very interesting ones, which I think we're all familiar with, that somebody discovers some way to do something, and they do it for a while. Then a remedy is discovered, and then that method disappears. There's these charts that are very interesting. There's some kind of method, and then the remedy is discovered, and they disappear. And then some new method appears, and then another remedy is discovered, and they disappear. So this is a kind of constant amount of work.
Now, Harvard OC3 ends somewhere, right? Somebody is Harvard's ISP.
Yeah, we buy that service from external providers.
So could those external providers choose filter apps?
See, I think one of the interesting things is, I mentioned this before, is that FAS buys its service from UIS. We don't have shared service with UIS. We buy it at a single point. So you go all the way up the line. You know, does FAS regulate FAS? Does UIS regulate Harvard? Does AT&T regulate the area? You know, these are a lot of questions we don't want to think about.
And this is a quick side question. I take it there are various Usenet groups. There are piles of messages on the Harvard FAS server. Are there Usenet groups dedicated, by name at least, to the trading of music, binary files of music? Eva, are those groups on the FAS server?
I don't know about the FAS server, but way before there was Napster, people were using that to do software more so than it's been around forever.
And has Harvard ever been known to be choosy about what news groups it lets on based on what activity it thinks the news group represents?
We bought newsgroup feeds from outside, and we took what we bought. We didn't restrict it internally. There were some restrictions that were imposed from the outside on things that were illegal activity, but we never restricted the use of the Usenet groups, as we don't restrict the activity on the network.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So I had a question which is kind of on this topic. Basically, so Usenet has a huge traffic of like pornography, movies, whatever you want to, and the problem there is that they can't handle the traffic. So there's like a handful of projects working on distributed data sort of storage, which is anonymous. So basically now you're completely helpless to do whatever you want, like any sort of blocking. So this is kind of a question for Professor Fisher, I guess. Like, I'm sure pretty soon, like, you know, year or so, people will have like the distributed anonymous data storage. So then you're completely like unable to do whatever, like to stop it. So, I mean, that makes the whole discussion a little bit of pointless, because next year it's not going to be valid at all. I mean, I can give you, like, examples. They're like freeheaven.net and others, which are just like, they're still beginning, but they're based on, like, very sort of stable theoretical ideas, so they're not going to be like, as Mr. Steen says, they're not going to go up and then down, because that's kind of stable cryptography.
Are there plans to go from OC3 to even thicker pipes so that people find stuff they want to do, they'll keep?
Well, you've got a couple of OC3s, right? Yeah.
Gotcha.
I have to say on the bandwidth issues, the 10 megabit to the desktop is 10 megabit to the desktop. The OC3 is a higher bandwidth, and that, of course, comes in to the university and is used in many areas, including the medical area. What Stanford did and other universities have done is just simply limit the bandwidth into particular areas, and indeed, that's the simpler solution if you can't go after particular activities, which you basically, as Scott notes, is a very difficult job. I mean, and potentially an impossible job. So that's always something, and it's a disturbing one because you want to keep the network available and so on. But there are other restrictions. We don't charge for use. You know, it unfortunately cries for things that are charge-based algorithms.
You could do a pay per listen if you wanted.
I think it would require a lot of work.
Yeah. Do you say something, Terry?
Well, a loosely related observation in relation to the last comment is one one circumstance I think that needs to be taken into account when we discuss cycles of, in pejorative terms, evasion and response, is degrees of ease of use. One of the things that's most remarkable about Napster is its simplicity. I consider myself quite an amateur in dealing with the internet. One of the things that's striking about Napster is the simplicity of it. And can you tell in Freenet are not so simple to operate? And some of the devices that to Scott are require, you know, a snap of a finger and programming are entirely beyond my capabilities. In guessing what's going to happen under these technological and legal constraints, I think we have to keep in mind not just will it be possible to do an end run around the next obstacle, but how many people will be doing an end run around the next next obstacle, and what will it do to the character of participation on the internet to be placing, in effect, restrictions of sophistication on those who can make use of the new technology. So it's one of the reasons why I find frustrating the chain of victories that have been secured in the last couple of months is not that it will prevent sophisticates from evading them, but it will prevent the large majority of unsophisticates on the internet from taking advantage of the new technology.
People with a blinking glass will know how to get around it.
Jonathan, one little follow-up on that.
Yeah.
One of the biggest effects of the challenge, the legal challenge to Napster, was actually a lot of people starting to work on GNUtella's user interface. So GNUtella's user interface is already better, and there's a lot of people spending a lot of time on it, so even people like you can use it.
And they're just doing it for fun, we think. do you have a question? So let's take these last two, and then we'll be ready to wrap up. Yeah, go ahead.
My name is Rick Osterberg. I actually work for Frank, a member of our security team, so I see a lot of these recording industry emails that Alan Ryan sees going back and forth. My question sort of for the group in light of policy versus technology, we keep talking about this dam and the holes being punched in it, and we're chiseling away at each side, and it's clear that as much as we keep damming up the dam, the holes are going to be keeping chiseled through, and this confidence is going to get through. If we keep seeing emails and notifications from the recording industry saying there's this IP address, they're doing bad things, please shut them down. It's clear that the intent of the recording industry is to be shutting down all these people doing what they allege are illegal activities. And they're saying this person doing illegal activity is a violation, this is our claim, please shut them down. Now, I think it's fair to say there's a whole lot more Napster activity going on campus than we're seeing notification from the recording industry. I'll say that without any evidence. If I'm a student, what I'm thinking is that historically there's really been no penalty. If I set up a Napster server, what happens is eventually someone will notice, I'll get a slap on the wrist, my senior tutor will say, stop that, and maybe I'll start it up again. Probably nobody will notice. If the recording industry is after all these people, why isn't the recording industry going after the individuals? If the university can harbor itself probably as just a carrier, if the other backbones can harbor themselves as a carrier, if we're talking about the person, the individual sitting in a room setting up an Napster server is the one violating copyright, why are they not going after these people? And I'm wondering how many lawsuits, you know, even though individually they will not get anything, how many lawsuits against a Harvard student does it take before Harvard students are petrified about running a Napster server?
Eva doesn't look scared yet, so what would it take to scare Eva into, yeah.
So Eva, if there was suddenly news in the Crimson tomorrow that there was a lawsuit pending from the recording industry to John Harvard, an undergraduate, would you be thinking twice about serving Napster?
Yes, and I actually think that sounds like a more effective approach than the RIA is taking, so maybe you've got a good point.
Terry, do you have insight into why they're not going after the Nats?
Well, the standard response to that I think is largely accurate, isn't it? It's very bad public relations to go after people close to the ground, ordinary consumers. And so that whereas for quite a long time, the legal case against individual copyists has been strong, and in some instances the evidence has been available to go after them, the recording industry doesn't want to, for the same reason that actually the FBI will never come after you in your home when you use your VCR for a fashion in violation of the little insignia that comes up in the beginning of the movie. They don't want the
country relationship. That and the mattress tags.
So it's analogous, actually, to the there's an analogous international development, which is the enforcement of the principal treaty involving copyrights, trade-related aspects of intellectual property systems, pressed on all of the 140 member countries of the World Trade Organization, largely by the United States, now obliges almost all countries in the world to provide effective copyright enforcement. Are they doing it? No, not yet. The large majority of countries in the world still have very weak, by Americanized, copyright systems, so the rate of software piracy remains in most countries in Southeast Asia over 90%. What's the United States doing? The United States is now, vis-a-vis these countries, in much the same position as the recording industry is vis-a-vis individual participants in the industry. Well, they're moving very gently in hopes of tightening the screws bit by bit without running afoul intense popular opposition in the relevant countries. It's a very delicate public relations campaign that the United States trade representatives and the individual countries that are pushing them, like Microsoft, are trying to engineer. And I think the recording industry is attempting an analogous campaign to pick their targets strategically, to gradually tighten the legal screws, at the same time to fight what they regard as the biggest danger of their position, namely the spread of a widespread expectation that music should be free. Whether they'll be successful or not, I don't know, but I think that's their strategy.
Gotcha. Doug, for last thing,
it seems to me that even if master is cleared by the courts, we're still going to have potentially this problem of bandwidth, master being a bandwidth hog. And I remember about 6 months ago when this was all blowing up and Metallica was sending their letters out, Napster was working with certain universities on ways to arrange it so that requests go within the internal network first before they go outside, and they were trying to get around that problem with universities who were really complaining more about bandwidth than about questions of legality. I'm curious if Harvard ever considered working with Napster on that, or if they have been looking into possible solutions for that?
No requests and no discussions. Once it becomes a legal site, I wouldn't be surprised if they asked us to optimize performance when it's fee-based, but no, there have been no discussions.
So if Napster is found to be legal and it still consumes, I guess, what you would consider to be a disproportionate amount of bandwidth, would Harvard still be curtailing Napster use?
Those decisions are actually made by each school today. So I suspect the university.
Divinity School enrollment skyrockets after three music policy introduced. All right, last question.
Yes. I have a question to Dan and Frank regarding Harvard's policy of maintaining this open network. Presuming that the ISPs that you contracted with started blocking Napster, would you then, as a matter of policy, change the ISP? I mean, is that how far we go with our open network, or would that be not a solution? It's too expensive.
The only scenario that would fit your question would be if one of the carriers that we purchase commercial internet connectivity from was to block access to Napster. That's this, how far upstream do you go and ask someone to block? I frankly don't know what we would do. If they were complying with a court order to do that, we might react to it differently than if they just did what other universities have done and, again, presumptively decide to do this. I frankly don't know what we would do. It would be non-trivial to switch these agreements midstream. And I doubt that will happen. I've seen no evidence of a suit being initiated against one of these real core internet infrastructure providers. So that scenario happily hasn't come up yet.
So I don't hear any big news coming out of the panel in the sense of, wow, right around the corner, the music could die. Hurry and download what you can while you still can. Indeed, it's sort of like John Brown's Still Dead. We're taking this deliberately, slowly, watching the courts, and certainly the sense I'm getting from Frank and from Dan is kicking and screaming will they try to get into the business with the university sort of being cop, vis-a-vis the students or the faculty. And even if the empirical data says there's a whole lot of stuff that, yeah, might be illegal under the law going on, the university wants no part of assisting somebody in finding out about it or taking action about it. A network is a network, and we're going to try to leave it alone as much as possible, with the only footnote being this odd 5.5 megabit cap on outgoing master traffic that may or may not stick around, but no one cares anyway because it's about what you can grab, not what you can push. And if there's to be movement on it, it's either going to come through the technology as new stuff comes around and people try to get around it, or through the law. Should a couple cases go the wrong way and Harvard's feet be put to the fire, either as Allen's number of copyright infringement reports starts to skyrocket and courts interpret that as, yeah, sorry, when you get subpoenaed, you've got to turn over the names, and maybe they can go after a couple students or something like that. That absent that, pretty much you're hoping to keep this floating along as it has been, keep good bandwidth going, and whatever you want to do with it, while we urge you by sticker and sign to think about copyright and your legal responsibilities, God bless you, do what you can with the network and enjoy. That's at least the sense I'm getting. And with that, I guess we should thank our sponsors, who are the Institute of Politics, the Harvard Political Union, the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. I've been asked by Eric Saltzman, the executive director, that if any of you wants to contribute in some way to the Berkman Center, you should see him or email us at cyber@law.harvard.edu or visit the homepage at cyber.law.harvard.edu. End of advertisement. With that, perhaps I guess we should thank our panel for helping to And without objection, I guess this very panel will soon be put up in MP3 and audio format available over the internet.